Okay.
Not bad.
We should be now on 8. Jeff and Tim.
All right.
I'd like to make a motion. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
What's that motion?
First time, Jerry. Does that count as a second?
Yeah.
The second investment of the day is kind of a mouthful. The Sigler Guff Distressed Real Estate Opportunities Fund II Co-Investment Fund. This is, it's best to think of this as an opportunity cleanup fund from Sigler Guff Distressed Real Estate Opportunities Funds 1 and 2. Funds 1 and 2 invested in both direct properties and underlying fund partnerships, so funds of distressed real estate properties. The direct property deal flow largely came from these underlying fund partnerships. So what this fund was created to do, instead of being kind of a DREOF 3, is really to capture additional direct property deal flow that's coming from the first two funds. This fund is the co-investment fund that is going to capture the co-investments that DREOFs 1 and 2 can no longer capture because capacity has constrained them and such. It is provided to investors of DREOF 2 as a rights offering. The mentality behind that is that the deal flow for the direct properties belongs to those people who provided capital for the first two funds that established relationships that then resulted in deal flow. It's a smaller fund, and relative to DREOFs 1 and 2, there's two reasons for that. One, it's the opportunity set is only on the direct property side. It's not looking at underlying funds, so the fund is going to be direct properties only. But the other side of it is something of the recognition that the commercial real estate distressed opportunity play is kind of on its last legs, definitely in the U.S., though there's still opportunities in Europe. And this is something that we actually identified in a memo to the board last September in a real estate pacing memo where we said we're seeing opportunities in Europe. If there's something that's available to capture those opportunities, we'd consider it. And then this came along. So this is same portfolio manager, Jim Coral, managing the same thing, direct properties only. Other nuances with the fund, in addition to being smaller, to echo our previous conversation, it is fees on invested capital only. Something we like, given that this is kind of the opportunity cleanup to pick up distressed real estate properties that are coming about as they come. It allows Jim Coral some discretion in how he chooses the properties. If he passes on properties, we're not on the hook for fees for him to make those decisions. The other facet of the fund that we'd want to highlight is that the preferred return for this fund is the same as the preferred return for the previous two funds that we've invested in. So the takeaway from that would be that we're looking for opportunities that are at least as good as opportunities that came from the previous funds despite being later in the real estate cycle.
Maybe just touch on why Europe is developing at this point in time.
Yeah, so the opportunity set in Europe is largely coming from the European Central Bank doing similar quantitative easing measures that the United States did several years ago, in addition to instability in the Eurozone. So there's banks are shedding real estate assets, and for those people who are well positioned to purchase them, there could be a real opportunity set. Part of Sigler Guff's strategy is partnering with the local experts. Europe tends to be kind of a clubby nature where outsiders can't get the best deals, so to speak. So the manager relationships established in the first two funds have provided kind of a sharpshooter network across Europe for Sigler Guff to pick up attractive properties.
So I don't know if this question is for you or them, but I know our Fed appointments are, is it 12-year? I just said I know and then I forgot.
it's one of the first.
They're long-term. I don't know about Draghi. I don't know how how firm his position is in terms of directing that quantitative easing policy and whether there's political risk that Draghi won't be there and it'll be, you know, somebody else, right?
Sure. Yeah, tough to predict the future. on the quantitative easing front, all we can comment on is the opportunity set as it is right now because it has been implemented and banks are shedding the assets.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's an important part of it, right? It's how it's coming across.
QE is providing, European QE is providing a background here, but I think we also need to be very cognizant that Basel III is driving some of this. So Basel III is global bank requirements to get their reserves up. European banking sector is a couple years behind the U.S. banking sector, where the, you know, the phrase that we kept using 4 years ago here was the extend them to 10. If I just extend that loan out, I think the asset will be good and everything will be fine. Well, we did that for a while in the U.S., and then QE kind of lifted up asset prices and the loan started to perform again. So QE is providing that same, is expected to provide that same kind of lifting of asset prices in Europe. But Basel III is requiring that all banks get their capital reserves up. And so since 2008, we've been looking at the German banks and saying, there's a lot of property on these books that we thought was going to shake free in 2009, in 2010, in 2011, in 2012. And lo and behold, here in 2015 and looking at 2016, it looks like it might actually happen. So the opportunity set might be larger. So buoyed by QE, but driven by Basel III. So even if QE fades, we still have the Basel III requirements.
Okay, so the driver in this is not really the quantitative easing. It's the fact that the opportunity was already there.
It's
a timing issue.
QE is throwing gas on a fire that's already lit by Basel III.
Okay.
Well, they were here a while ago, a year or two ago. It seemed like it was the same thing, though, that they were saying, like, in Ireland, different things going on and trying to get rid of. So it's not like the same story, only a year or two later. So it's something is.
Oh, go ahead. Size got bigger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So there's more deal flow than was expected. And so there's not enough for, quote unquote, a new fund. So this is we're seeing additional deal flow above and beyond, attractive deal flow above and beyond what we expected to see.
Got it.
And therefore, we're going to go back to Fund 2 investors and said, would you like a little bit more? We're seeing a little bit more capacity here.
This is going back for a moment to fees. Basically, every one of these fees are a fairly high level, have board interest at a fairly high level. One of the things that strikes me that we might do, and sometimes models work and sometimes they aren't helpful, but in this particular case, and I think in most of these, if we had a model of what fees we would expect to pay if we earn 0%, 5%, 15%. I'm just obviously picking three numbers here so that we have some idea of what the range would be. What fees would we pay? And the model should show from various forms. It's carried interest, management fee, other fees. So that there's some actual dollar amount against our $25 million or $50 million that is a part of your summary that goes on top of the presentation by the outside fund managers. I think our group would find that very
useful. You just made Jeff's day.
Jeff wants to do that. Good.
If you look at page 8 of your memo.
Did I miss that on the memo?
Very back page.
All right. Well, Thank you.
And the difference from your example is instead of looking at the specific return number, we looked at the multiple number. It's generally more how we evaluate these private funds as the multiple of invested capital. The fees, the management fees for something like this, there's a lot of assumption that goes into a model like this. You have to assume a certain amount, especially when fees are on invested capital. You have to assume that attractive opportunities are found, a percentage of the capital is deployed. So understanding that this cash flow model is, there are a lot of assumptions embedded in this. Specifically, the fund is 99% called. The capital calls include those calls for management fees. So against the $25 million, $23.9 million is actually invested in real estate properties. The difference in fees, when it's based on the total amount of commitment that is then invested, those won't actually change over the course of the fund in terms of what the return is. What will change is the carried interest, whether it's earned or not earned. What we've included here in this model is a 1.5 multiple. You didn't earn any carried interest. At 1.8, you hit your preferred return, or 1.9 basically, you hit your preferred return and you're moving towards carried interest, and at a 2.0 multiple you've earned some carried interest. And those carried interest numbers can be netted out of the bottom line return of realized profits.
So it's fees embedded as the overall cash flow. So we're thinking about this in a holistic. How much are we deploying in fee dollars to acquire this expected cash flow? So this is how we think about it. But I think, John, your question is embedded in the numbers here.
I'm going to have to work at it. Okay.
Sure.
That's aiming towards that kind of a goal. I sort of tend to think in terms of absolute numbers as contrasted to, you know, abbreviations or embedded in or that kind of thing.
Yeah. And just so you understand kind of our perspective here, we're saying per fee dollar spent, what can we buy? Can we buy $2 in return for a dollar in fee? It's positive. We're happy with that. For a dollar spent, do we get a dollar 10 off something else? Well, $2 is better than a dollar 10. So it's that fee efficiency measure that we're striving for at the staff level.
Okay.
I'm okay spending $100 million. I'm okay spending $1 billion, provided it's an efficient use of fund resources and acquiring more return for the fee dollar spent. So we're less concerned about absolute level than we are about efficiency.
If there is a consistent model that the board gets used to seeing, that strikes me as being very helpful in this. It is that buying $2 for a dollar is good, buying 50 cents for a dollar not so good, and they see that lined up each time.
And I wish we would have gotten there already with Verus, but it's an ongoing conversation of trying to develop a model with them and with their team.
Okay.
We're hopeful in first quarter we're going to have something.
Yeah. Great. Good.
So a few quick comments on the fund structure before we bring in Sigler Guff. Relative to DREOF 1 and 2, it's a shorter fund. It's a two-year commitment period, recognizing kind of the opportunity set is transient, and it's looking at a 10-year total fund life, again, on direct property, so there's not that second layer of deployment timing going through an underlying partnership. Relative to the two predecessor funds, or two kind of primary funds, slightly lower management fee and 5% lower on the carried interest. So it's opportunistically structured, shorter term, slightly lower fees. We view this all as positive. Any other questions, or should we bring them in?
Or Brian can make a motion.
Yeah.
Jerry's not here to defend himself.
That's
what happens when you leave a meeting early. I mean,
exactly.
It wasn't by accident he left early, maybe.
By the first quarter.
Yeah, listen to the tape.
From Atlanta. Good
morning.
Good morning.
This one is went from 35, so if it do 35, 70%.
Yeah.
I saw almost 2012, so it looks like that might have been.
So Lander was up and coming.
Good morning. This is your presentation, so I assume one of you plans on taking the initial lead and introduce yourselves and go from there.
Sure. Thank you again for having us this morning, and thank you very much for your support over the years, both in our small buyout and in our distressed real estate funds. My name is Matt Brewer. I'm responsible for marketing and client service on the West Coast for Sigler Guff. I'm joined by Jim Coral, who some of you have probably met in the past. Jim's the head of our distressed real estate funds at Sigler Guff. Reason we're here today, we are currently raising a small $250 million distressed real estate co-investment vehicle that we are offering to our existing distressed real estate fund 2 investors. We've gotten to a point now where We're over 80% committed in Distressed Real Estate Fund II, but still have substantial deal flow that's coming off of our existing relationships, deal flow that we believe will last at least through 2017. So we're structuring this vehicle in a way where we believe at least 90% of the fund will be existing Distressed Real Estate II investors. It's going to have a 2-year investment period, again, direct and co-investment only, no fund investments, and it's really to take advantage of the remaining deal flow that we see opportunistically in this cycle. 2 years out, it's really hard to say what's going to happen. The opportunity set in real estate has really evolved quite a bit over the course of the last couple of years, and we don't necessarily believe it's going to exist, at least with the types of returns that we're underwriting to, more than 2 years from now. So that's why we're raising a small fund, direct investments only, and are putting a 2-year investment period on it. And because of the way that our business works, it's really the capital that folks like you provide to us that generates these relationships and generates this deal flow. That's why we want to give existing investors in our funds the first opportunity to take their share before we would look to take it out to anybody else. So with that, unless anybody has any questions, I thought I'd turn it over to Jim to provide a real quick update on your investments with us, then we can walk you through the current opportunity set, a little bit more about the rationale as far as why we're raising this fund and how we plan to go ahead and execute it over the next couple of years.
Well, I'd like to, hello everyone, I'd like to start by seconding what Matt said. You all have been tremendous partners for us and, you know, going back to our Fund One, and we really appreciate that and are, you know, certainly amongst our very largest investors, and we're, you know, happy to be able to come out to you today and you know, start by telling you how well your Fund One and Two investments are doing, and I think that's an important, provides an important backdrop for the case for investing in this vehicle, which is kind of, we kind of view it as kind of a, you know, wrap-up vehicle to sort of like mop up the additional great deals that we still see out there. But just quickly, you know, by way of review, I do want to go back to Fund 1 and 2 just for a couple minutes because I do think that sets a great backdrop. So I'm going to start on page 2, and we're going to turn some pages quickly. I'm not going to get bogged down, hopefully. You know, DREOF 1, or Distressed Real Estate Opportunity Fund 1, DREOF as we call it, is really in harvest mode right now. I'll go over the returns a little bit that we've been achieving, particularly the returns on the direct deal side, because I think those will be indicative of what you can expect for the new vehicle. The second fund, DREOF 2, you know, we're about 9 months since we had the final close at the end of last year. The portfolio construction there is nearly complete and will be completed. We'll be about 100% committed on that fund in about 60 days, and I think about 40% of that capital has been drawn. And I hope you'll see from looking at that fund, and particularly the more recent investments that we made, that the that our value-oriented investment style, you know, our old adage, you know, we want to buy a dollar's worth of real estate, good quality real estate for 50 cents, is really what enables us to, you know, set up to get the type of returns that we like. And, of course, it's those types of situations which, particularly in the U.S., are becoming, you know, increasingly rare. They're just harder to find. But I hope you'll see how that value-oriented style sets us up for the returns we'd like to achieve. And so with that Fund 1 and 2, quick background as a backdrop, and then we'll launch into the terms on the co-investment fund, and I think that'll be helpful to help you understand why we're doing that. So on page 4 real quickly, and again I'm going to turn these pages quickly, first fund, $630 million, closed at the end of 11, about 90% called, 40% of the capital has been distributed back to you. The total net return has been about 14.6% so far, and we believe that that number will gravitate up towards more closer to 20% net as the realizations continue to play out. For now, I'd like to highlight with regard to this fund the direct co-investment returns, which you see separated out here in this box on the bottom, total gross IRR of 21.7%. That's what we've been achieving on the direct deals, which have consistently performed a little bit better than the fund investments that we've been making. So on the next page, page 5, you know, looking at the Fund 1 portfolio a little more closely, you can see overall the fund investments we've made 20.1%. The reported returns on the North American funds are consistently high, but let's take a look at the ones that are kind of in more of the advanced stages of liquidation, because what you find is, you know, the numbers marked here are fine, they're good, but when the actual realizations come in, the returns are, you know, the actual returns at the end of the day, you know, we've been experiencing have been significantly higher. So look at the first one there, Exeter Industrial Fund 2. All the way over on the right side, you know, marked today at a 1.5 times equity multiple and a 23.8% IRR. That's what the accountants are telling us the return is going to be. But we just received news from the manager that basically that entire fund is going to be liquidated in one big transaction before the end of the year, and the return on that fund is going to be about a 39% IRR and a 2.3 times equity multiple for that whole vehicle. And that whole fund will be liquidated at that time. Same with Savannah Real Estate Fund 2, about midway down there. That one also is almost fully liquidated. There are a couple more assets yet to be liquidated. And it's right now at a 1.8 times and 25.4%. And I think you'll see that pick up closer to 2 times multiple and maybe high 20s IRR. So you can see that, you know, the marks are what they are, but at the end of the day, the type of returns that this strategy is capable of demonstrating, I think, are, you know, even higher than what we've seen so far. Just one quick comment on the European funds. You can see the returns there as marked are a little lower, but they are those funds came later in the fund's life. So the value creation hasn't really had the chance to sort of flow through yet. I say these marks are very conservative. They're basically marked at, you know, cost minus expenses, with very few, you know, kind of markups. But we have, you know, we fully believe that these will perform at the same level as the U.S. funds. On page 6, the direct portfolio, the returns on the direct deals slightly higher on an overall basis, 21.7%. And when we ultimately expect, again, the multiple to get to about a 2 times multiple when the actual, you know, harvested returns, which tend to be higher, sort of come in. On page 7, that portfolio certainly is diversified by asset class. On page 8, it's certainly diversified by geography. I won't spend a lot of time on that because I think the most important characteristic of the portfolio and what really drives the returns is not the diversification. It's not really what it is or where it is, but it's really the value embedded in the portfolio, the discounts to intrinsic value. And that's here on page 9. You'll see, you know, as I said, we like to buy $1 worth of real estate for 50 cents. In Fund 1, we bought $1 worth of real estate for 59 cents, and that's generating the types of returns, you know, we were just talking about. 59% of what we view as the intrinsic value of the real estate, which is essentially what it costs to rebuild that building in the same location, the exact same building that's there today. And this value-oriented style is really what we think is a pathway to high returns. It's what we're going to continue with for the co-investment fund, but it is, they are getting harder to find, and that's why this, as we talked about, this co-investment fund will be smaller. So let's take a quick look at some of the actual realizations of direct deals in Fund 1. Very quickly, on page 11, you know, this is a warehouse we bought in August of 11. And on page 12, you can see we liquidated it in December of 13 for 56.4% IRR and a 2.6 times multiple. On page 13, here's one we bought in January of 11, again, and sold at the end of 14 for 28% and 2.5 times. Here's another one in Dallas on page 15, bought in early 11, sold late 14 for 28% and 2.3 times multiple. Here's on page 17, a bank recapitalization. You may remember this deal. We recapitalized a real estate bank, which was essentially a publicly traded portfolio of real estate loans that we valued and looked at like a portfolio of loans, bought at a big discount alongside our distress group in 2011. And on page 18, when we were fully liquidated, generated a 1.8 times multiple and a 23% gross IRR. So that's kind of the Fund 1 review. I want to take a quick look, again, at that Fund 2 portfolio that we're building, which we think is going to continue to generate the same types of returns. On page 20, now this is really germane, I think, to the co-investment vehicle. You know, this chart is really supposed to represent the various silos of opportunity within real estate, and it's meant to show how the opportunity set has evolved as we've gone through the cycle here. You can see some of the silos are no longer presenting value towards the top of the page, and some others have kind of opened up more recently, particularly those in Europe. Where you see the recovery in real estate asset pricing in Europe is really two or three years behind that of the U.S. So you see the opportunity set box for Fund 2/2A, which is kind of our nickname for this co-investment vehicle, are really accessing a lot of similar opportunities, but some new ones as well. So on page 21, you can see Fund 2, it's an $877 million fund, of which $722 million is committed today to about two-thirds to funds and about one-third to direct deals. And like I said, we're processing about another $150 million of transactions today, and in about 60 days, that fund is going to be about 100% committed, and that marries up nicely, I think, to the closing that we're going to have on the new fund, which is going to be at the end of October. And we're, you know, really sort of trying to orchestrate the closings of deals right now so we can not miss anything and close on what we're going to close for the rest of Fund 2 and then move right into the to the co-investment vehicle. And this fund, as I mentioned, we're finding more of the opportunities in Europe today. About half of Fund 2 is in Europe. And then finally on page 22, you can see, you know, this time, interestingly, we've been able to unearth even more interesting value over the last couple years. We've done about 12 direct deals so far in Fund 2, purchased at about 46% of replacement cost, 46% of intrinsic value, 46% of what it would cost to rebuild those buildings today. These types of deep discounts should set this portfolio up as well for those same types of returns that we'd like to see. And you can see that the discounts have persisted, you know, through the life of deployment of this fund, and we feel that we will be able to continue to achieve these type of valuation metrics. In our estimation, we think there's about another $250 million worth out there that we'll find over the next couple of years, and that's why we're really targeting that size for this fund. So with that as kind of an intro, let's focus on the co-investment fund vehicle. It's kind of laid out there on page 24, and let me talk to you specifically about why this fund is structured the way it is. There are some sort of structural tweaks here, and I think it's important, you know, for anyone that wants to come into this fund to understand that these structural tweaks are in place strictly to in response to the changing opportunity set on the ground, right? And starting with the target fund size, $250 million, right? We're not going out and raising a whole nother big fund because we see the opportunity set really as the cycle matures to be certainly diminishing in the U.S., and we think there's maybe a couple years left to go in Europe before that one starts, you know, shrinking as well. So smaller fund reflecting a smaller opportunity set. We preached that for many years. Now we're applying it, you know, to ourselves. The investment objective remains the same. Where's a dollar's worth of real estate trading for 50 cents? We need to go find those deals. The commitment period is 2 years rather than the usual three. This is, you know, also highly unusual. We're really thinking that over the next couple years approximately, I mean, you can never time these things perfectly, but our view is over the next 2 years, you know, we'll still be able to find these special situations where you can find that dollar trading for 50 cents. But boy, by the time you get to 2018, it's very difficult for us to imagine that you're going to be able to unearth these types of value opportunities when you get as far down the road as 2018. As Matt mentioned, this is also a direct deals only vehicle. There are going to be no fund investments, so it's really not a fund of funds per se, or even a part of a fund of funds. Really, direct deals. And that's really because if we were to invest in a fund, let's say in January 1 of 2016, you know, that fund, that underlying fund is going to have a 3-year investment period, and we're basically giving that guy discretion to go off and invest in 16, 17, and 18. And we just kind of said that we don't, you know, 18 is kind of beyond our horizon at this point, and we just don't think that it's likely that there'll be great deals out there to do. So we just say, you know what, a fund vehicle is just not right for this, you know, for this. For this next period of time. The management fee this time around is going to be a 1% management fee on invested capital only. Not on commitments. This is, you know, certainly a very investment-friendly term, but it's really designed to be, you know, what I call it is it's your hedge. It's your hedge against the possibility that we might be wrong, and instead of being able to find, you know, $250 million of great deals out there to do over the next couple of years, maybe we can only find $150 million, okay? In which case, you know, a year out or 2 years out, you say, you know what, we're just, you know, we only found $150 million worth, and we're shutting down the investment period, or it shuts naturally at the end of its 2 years, and that $100 million that we did not call down from investors, you know, those investors will not have been burdened by having paid a management fee on capital that was never put out and deployed and generated a return. So this is what kind of what that fee on invested capital only is really all about. The carried interest, you know, our promote structure is the same. You know, the geographical investment restriction we have loosened up because since we're, you know, we will be in our, we envision that we will be searching harder to try to find those types of value opportunities, and so we kind of released or, you know, loosened the geographical restrictions. You know, we don't know whether it's going to be, you know, 40% U.S. and 60% Europe, or 60% U.S. or 40% Europe, but I imagine it'll be somewhere in that, you know, in that sort of zone. But we don't really know at this point, since it's a very opportunistic strategy. So we basically said certainly at least 85% of the fund will come from you know, collectively the U.S. and Europe, and I would include the U.K. in that, you know, in that definition of Europe. And finally, the offering, right? I mean, this is really important philosophical point to us. You know, This is really being, you know, we're really characterizing this as a rights offering. And, you know, Matt touched on this, and, you know, for me this is really important because it's been the capital that you all have entrusted us with that's given us the market position to be out there hunting for deals for the last, you know, 5 years. And as a result of that presence in the marketplace, you know, we've been able to generate a lot of deal flow. We're enjoying tons and tons of deal flow. It's never been better. There have never been as many people in the marketplace that understand how we execute, understand what our value criteria are, and are showing into us, you know, really interesting proprietary deal flow, which this fund is going to go out and capture. And we feel like that is a valuable asset that essentially belongs to the investors. And so we want to, you know, because proprietary deal flow that is off market, you know, it's a valuable asset, and we want to offer it to you all and the other investors. And we've gotten a great response, about, well, $225 million of the $250 million of demand has been created by the existing investors. So 90% of this fund, that, you know, I'm presuming, which is obviously too early to presume, but if you were to come in for your piece, that would mean 90% of the of this vehicle of $250 million would be taken up by the existing investors. And that makes me super happy because I feel like, you know, that the existing investors are the ones that put us in this position in the first place, and we like to offer this what we think is a valuable asset to them. So we're very happy that that most of the investors have come back and want to participate in this vehicle. So maybe at that point I should stop and see if there are any questions before I kind of go into a little more detail on maybe some of the things we've done recently, which might give you, indicate what the deal flow, you know, what we do tomorrow probably looks a lot like what we did yesterday, so might illustrate some of those, but first, I've gone over a lot pretty quickly, so if there are any.
How many Fund 2 investors have signed up?
Dozens, I would say. I would say just about all of the sizable investors have come back with accepting a pro rata share, and in most cases, I think it's fair to say that the larger the investor, the more likely that they are coming back requesting more than their pro rata share, because we went out to everyone with a pro rata share. Yours is 19 something, and you've indicated that you would be possibly interested in something like 25. Each of the three largest investors are, you know, have done the same thing, and I would say, you know, many others have. It's really some of the, you know, much smaller investors, or, you know, or folks that, you know, for whom this compressed time frame, you know, doesn't really fit into their investment program, or they're just kind of capped out on real estate for the current, you know, fiscal year or whatever. But most of them have come back and embraced this. So,
what's your timeline to wrap it up?
So we got indications of interest from everyone, from all the existing investors, at the end of August. It's at that point that we said, okay, we've got $225 million in demand for this $250 million vehicle. So that's great. And we've told everyone at the outset that we would have a closing on this fund, where all those folks would have to you know, get all their ducks in a row for an October 31st closing. And we certainly have every expectation that that, you know, most, if not all, of that 225 will show up on October 31. And if it doesn't, you know, there are some folks that we kind of have sort of, you know, waiting in the wings to see if there's any kind of unsubscribed portion that they would like. But certainly, if there is any unsubscribed portion, you know, we'd certainly rather have our existing investors take that up. But to the extent all the existing investors have gotten what they want, then we do have a couple folks on the sidelines waiting to see if there's a piece for them. So that's kind of how we envision it playing out.
So is this later in your cycle? Are we getting near the end? Or are we one of the last of the funds to?
No. Everyone's going to be coming in October 31. I mean, we got the indication of interest at the end of August, and the actual hard commitment is due October 31, and that way we'll, you know, the hard commitments from all the existing investors, and at that point we'll assess, you know, who all made it to the finish line, and you know, we're monitoring where everyone is in their process, and we assume everyone will make it there. But at that point there'll be, say, we anticipate 25 million left of additional capacity, and there are, you know, kind of multiple parties that are kind of ready to take that up between now and the end of the year if they
yeah, I guess what I'm asking you is, how many other funds have you know, actually committed by an affirmative vote prior to today? Well, you know, without asking who.
Yeah, I would say most, certainly, you know, the other two investors that I would put in your size category have already kind of board approved the amounts that they're talking about, you know, and many of the others is those kind of more medium sized ones as well. As far as I know, I don't think we're actually waiting for, you know, for board approval from any of the other meaningful size investors. So
even though it was a non-binding indication of interest, the vast majority of the people got a binding decision by the time they filled out the non-binding interest. So at this point, we think there's very little variability relative to, you know, the 225 that was asked for and what we get at the end of the day. It's pretty solid.
No, I was just trying to figure out where we were on the list. It sounds like we're down the list.
No, actually.
Well, you might be a little later in terms of when your actual approval may, you know, or may not come. But I would say that you're at the top of the list in terms of folks that we want to make sure that you have everything you want, and I think we, you know, made that clear, you know, to the team that let us know if they, because, you know, there are a few more bucks of this thing floating around if you like. I mean, we want to make sure that our, you know, large and valuable investors are you know, are fully satisfied before we open it up to, you know, kind of the backstop candidates, you know.
Thanks.
Any other questions of our guests?
Jim, do you maybe want to spend just a couple minutes talking about some of the most recent deals to give a flavor for what we're working on right now? Would that be helpful?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to. If y'all have patience or the inclination, I do think.
How are we doing time wise?
Real quickly, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
One deal, Jim.
One. Okay. Okay. Well, yeah. So you can see all of our managers on page 25. You know, we've executed with we've evaluated a direct deal with from all of these managers, nearly all of them. We've executed with about half of them. You can see all the deals we've done on page 26. This is every direct co-investment deal we've done. about 40 of them, and at an average of 52% replacement cost. So our, you know, we've kept true to our style of we want to buy dollars worth of real estate trading for 52 cents. So so in light of that, let's look at one that's recent. And of course, you know, gosh, you make me pick one. I mean, I know you're gonna like think, oh, you cherry pick the best one, but they're all. You know, like you love all your children, right? So just love them.
No.
You love them.
I only have one. So
the report is my favorite and she's my least favorite.
Jerry, where do your kids hear that?
They've heard it.
They got to figure out which one you don't like. Yeah.
These meetings are recorded.
Here's like an indicative one, I think. We closed in February this year. It's on page 45.
Oh.
And it's very recent. But it's also, we've had it a few months now, and so enough to actually get something done on it. So it kind of illustrates, you know, how kind of once you get in there with your sort of value-added manager and you know, you get some elbow grease going, you know, what you can really do. So this is a classic Dreyoff-type investment. It's in a very hot submarket of Atlanta, which the capital is really not. Been really turned on to at the time that we kind of put this under contract. If you look at the aerial on page 46, you can see it's in a very dense. It's an older office building, Class B office complex in a very dense part of Atlanta. You know, it's right here at a big freeway interchange. You know, you're building houses. The density is really increasing here. But basically, the owner here is a life insurance company who'd held it forever, and their business plan just didn't work out, and they're really asleep at the switch. But what's been happening around this has been very exciting. Page 47, you can see that overhead map. This is why this is a hot market in Atlanta. You've had Mercedes-Benz decide to move their U.S. headquarters here. Cox just, you know, doubled down and built a brand new headquarters here. State Farm is building a new headquarters here. And you can see our little yellow pie slice over there by the freeway interchange. You know, we're gonna, we're right in the middle to pick up on all this ancillary business. So we bought this thing for $41 million, closed in February, at $102 a square foot. There's about two-thirds discount to what it would cost to rebuild this real estate today, so great, you know, great value. Bought it for a third less than what the last guy bought it for back in 2007, so that's nice. So what we've done already here is we've... So we... it's always good when the last guy, took a loss. $15 million. We've already got $15 million in cash back from this deal out of 41 that we spent because we, as you can see from page 46, a lot of excess land. There was a kind of a hidden asset here. We had development rights for 500 multifamily units. As you can see from that overhead, there's housing being constructed. There's huge demand for apartments in this area. So we sold off the land for $12 million to an apartment developer that's going to turn one of those little parking lots into a bunch of housing. We actually were eminent domain for one little acre that we couldn't use anyway because of the topography for another $3 million. So that basically reduced our basis in the office buildings to, if you want to think about it like that, to $65 a square foot, incredibly cheap. And with the offices, we bought it. It was 40% leased. The life company had really not been focused on leasing it up. In fact, they had mothballed a couple of buildings because they were going to try to tear down those buildings and build like a huge, you know, palace because they thought this location warranted it. Instead, we said, let's just lease this stuff up. It's a viable B office complex in this hot submarket. So we've taken it already from 40% leased at closing to 55% leased. The rents have gone from $19 to $21, it's filling up. It's gushing cash, and I'd say, you know, we're well on our way to completing the business plan here, probably in the next 18 months. Yes, sir.
Did you know about the eminent domain risk when you bought the property?
We knew that they were looking at this and they wanted to expand, you know, that off ramp. But we also knew, you know, what piece they were interested in. We said, you know, that's not going to impact us from okay. It was only a question of they were looking at it. It was only a question of how much they were going to pay. They did their own sort of process and figured out, you know, what the market value was. And it was really $3 million of, you know, basically manna from heaven. Because the, you know, topography of the site is such that could never be built upon, and it didn't take away any of our, you know, apartment entitlements or anything like that. So,
quick question: yes, usually, naming rights come with anchor tenants. Is Wells Fargo still an anchor tenant in this building?
Yes, it is. In fact, we're well on our way. You're seeing on the opposite page, the facing page.
Yeah.
That's actually a different project in Boca Raton.
Oh, it's a different project. I'm sorry, Boca Raton. Okay, same question, different location.
Yeah, but that is, but we're renewing them for much longer term, and they'll be the, you know, they'll be the brand tenant in the marketplace, and you know, that has real value when it comes time to sell something like that. So.
Yeah, regardless of the location, it has value.
Yeah. So, you know, this, I mean, this is the type of deal that, you know, to be able to buy this type of real estate, you know, this cheap in such a hot market, I mean, frankly, if the market were anywhere close to rational, this type of deal would not be out there, you know, given where we are in the cycle in the U.S. But that's, you know, really our job and our mandate to our managers that work with us is, hey, you know, go find these needles in the haystack that, you know, where we can buy that dollars worth of good quality real estate at 50 cents. And we'll keep doing those while we can, and when we can't, we won't do them anymore. So.
And this was a product, a proprietary deal flow. This was an off market.
Yes. Yeah. So we, I think there were, you know, clear. We already own another asset in this marketplace, which you can see on the overhead here, right by where that two, the right on page 47. The right, there's a 285 sign.
State Farm.
Right, yeah, just below State Farm. We actually bought a vacant building there and filled it up with State, you know, it was 80% vacant. We brought in State Farm to take the other 80%, filled it up, and are basically preparing that for sale. So, you know, and Crocker has another project that's more of a ground-up development project in this marketplace, too. So, you know, they're very much, they've got a, you know, very, they're very much in this marketplace. They've got a great footprint. You know, they heard about this. Tom Crocker has been, you know, kind of had his eye on this piece of property for many years. He's been waiting for the life company to sort of exhaust themselves with their, you know, business plan. And when I do believe it was shown to one other party, which was actually the apartment builder. The apartment, interestingly, the apartment builder that we wound up carving out a piece of land to and selling it to him for $12 million was actually looking at buying the whole thing, the whole office complex, just to get to the apartment land. But because they were having to buy something that was non-core to them, right, they couldn't really get as aggressive. So we were, I mean, I think we were basically bidding in an indirect way against that one party. But they were sort of like not the perfect bidder. So.
Thanks.
Okay, I could
summarize.
Yeah.
This is where Francis is.
Any other questions on this or any other? Or?
You wanted to quickly summarize what you have presented to us? And
sure. Well, I think again, you know, this is we've said from the get-go with the strategy that we want to be, you know, value-oriented investors. Because real estate is not a growth industry, so if you want to try to be a growth investor in real estate, you tend to be disappointed. So we don't pay high multiples for real estate cash flow. We like to sell to people that want to pay high multiples for real estate cash flow, but we leave that value outperforms the ability to buy dollars worth of real estate for 50 cents. But we're also cycle aware. That's the second component of our strategy, and what that really means is you have to understand that the period of time in the cycle when you can buy a dollar's worth of good real estate for 50 cents, it doesn't last forever. You can't do that 10 years out of 10. The cycle goes up and down, and you can buy it like, you know, when it's down here, but when you get to about here in the cycle, you just can't do that anymore. And so that's where we are, right? We're at the end of that ability to buy a dollar's worth of real estate for 50 cents in the developed economies of the U.S. and Europe. And, you know, this has always been our strategy. Our team's got to be small enough to not always be out, you know, raising a new fund. And when it's time to stop and turn our attentions from being mostly a buyer to being mostly a seller, you know, that's what we're going to do. And the time is nigh for us to do that. And what you're seeing here is really, this is really, it's a cleanup vehicle. It's we've got a lot of great stuff out there already lined up that we want to do for this. Probably 100 to 125, you know, we already have a pretty good sense of how a lot of these deals are going to come in that we're, you know, working on underwriting right now, you know, and like I said, this is our wrap up, and you know, we were there at the start, and we'd love to have you there at the finish, and you know, like I said, we're very proud of being able to come back here and tell you about a lot of good numbers, and I'd like to do that one more time.
These are deals that you're already working on with anticipating getting the money.
proprietary and
for the third vehicle, yeah. I mean, right now, I mean, I didn't want to, you know, bother you with a 10-page list of our, you know, current and the, all the deals we passed on, got outbid on, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a current list right now of about 15, and I guess that, you know, five are very active, and we anticipate that we'll actually, you know, we will probably take those down subsequent to the October close, you know, with the very same types of value metrics that we're talking about right here, which are, you know, big discounts, replacement costs, like significant in-place yield, but with a lot of vacancy. So if you get that value-added manager in there to sort of stabilize the cash flow and build it up, you're going to be close to a 10% unlevered yield, and you'll be able to double our money on those types of transactions. So
I'm not seeing a proprietary.
It's at the end.
It's at the end. All right.
I was trying to flip through the pages on my iPad. I didn't see it.
Be scrolling a lot.
You need to waive that. This is a public meeting, and we can only deal with public information.
We redacted the names of the managers on this list purposely. Was the deck structured properly for?
There's a statement at the very end that this is a confidential in the disclosures. That this is confidential and proprietary.
Okay. I know that there was a second version of the deck that came out that removed that particular language, which we can get back to you. If that's what you guys need to publish it.
It's on page 55, the third paragraph.
So it's just that you understand that this is a public meeting.
Can't apply to this
being recorded. Any materials presented are available to the public.
Yes.
Yeah, no, we prepared this deck specifically with that understanding, so I apologize if it didn't flow through to the disclosure thing in the back, which obviously was sort of boilerplate, so they may not have caught
that. Yes, that's not a problem. We just ask you to waive that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions of our guests? Jim? Yeah, thank you.
Great. All right, thank you very much for having us. Appreciate it.
Take care.